On this episode of That Was a Show,
Everything's Relative was a show. We're not joking. There's another failed sitcom with this title. This one was created by Mitchell Hurwitz. And spoiler, not much happens in it. Bryn, Aaron, and Barry have a great time talking about this show, but actually more fun talking about Arrested Development. Plus, Aaron misremembers and fabricates another memory like he did with the premise of the John Larroquette show.
We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince, but those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production. All right, guys, let's do this. Let's do another episode.
All right, why don't you tell everybody what we watched this week?
Well, apparently we're doing another show called Everything's Relative, which is not a mistake. This is a different Everything's Relative from 1999. Bryn, why are we doing this?
Well, we're doing it mainly because I just thought it would be funny to do another sitcom with the same title. But yeah, there's other reasons why I chose it, and you'll find out. So this sitcom that also happens to be called Everything's Relative aired mid-season on NBC in April of 1999. Six episodes were produced, but only four aired. It followed TV comedy writer Leo Gorlick, played by Kevin Rahm, and his dysfunctional and wacky relationship with his divorced parents, Jake Gorlick, played by Jeffrey Tambor, and Mickey Gorlick, played by Jill Clayburgh, and his brother Marty, played by Eric Schaefer. This short-lived show was created by Mitchell Hurwitz and definitely seems like a direct predecessor to his later sitcom creation, Arrested Development. We watched the pilot and episode 4 for this podcast. I chose it because, again, I thought it would be funny to cover a sitcom with the exact title of the previous episode, and I saw that it was created by Mitchell Hurwitz, so it was just off to the races from there.
Absolutely. I just have to say, that was a very, very precise show description. I'm sure everybody out there listening knows that is a lot cleaner than our show descriptions usually are. I liked it. I was a fan.
Wow.
Usually Aaron and I will ramble for like 7 minutes.
Yeah.
See, I like going on a long journey with my show descriptions. A lot of unnecessary turns of phrase, if you will.
Yeah.
That's what keeps this show interesting. You got three distinct flavors in the stew. You don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all different styles.
I like to just get down to the meat of it. Like, what can I say?
Yeah.
I like six different kinds of mushrooms in my stew.
Oh, boy.
See, even takes this too far.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into it.
Let's get
right. Oh, we're going to get into it.
Let's get right into this.
Yeah. I'm going to kick off this commentary with a couple of interesting observations about how this is similar to Arrested Development. And then we can talk about all the ways that it is different. And that it does not succeed in the areas where Arrested Development did succeed. But okay, to start off with, it's a single camera sitcom. And clearly, like after watching these two episodes that we watched, I needed to watch the Arrested Development pilot because I was just curious. Like, I didn't want my memories of Arrested Development to be colored by the entirety of 3+ years of jokes and laughs and things like that. I wanted to just like compare directly pilot to pilot.
Pilot to pilot, there's a lot of similarities.
And you've got a show that is examining a relationship within a dysfunctional family. You have the relationships between adult siblings, between the adult children and their parents who have a dysfunctional marriage. You have the main son and the dad who are in the same line of work. So there are already like certain specific things, certain threads that this show is pulling on that seem to be similar.
Yeah. I mean, the wacky family, the dysfunction, that's like very much tracks. And I can't help but think, like, obviously Mitchell Hurwitz is like putting in flavor from his own life or something. Like, there's obviously like something that he can relate to with these like family relationships, because you keep seeing it over and over again. And like the fact that Leo, the main character of Everything's Relative, is a comedy writer who basically mines his family for like comedy content is like a meta commentary. Yeah. Like that's how I interpreted it. I feel like it's all meta commentary. I feel like it's like, haha, see, this is what I do, but the character, I'm making my character do it.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah. I didn't make that connection. Also, like, I want to say just briefly on the camera work, okay? 1999 was a time when TV comedy was starting to transition from being dominated by multi-cam stage plays to these single-cam, more cinematic shows. And you know, Arrested Development was one of the first shows that did this extremely well. And this show, a mere 4 years earlier, is doing single cam, but the vibe is weird. To me, like right off the bat, it feels like either some sort of weird TV drama style from like a cop procedural, or maybe a comedy, but like a theatrical comedy that's like taking a long time to ease its way into the first act. Like it just, it was distracting. The camera work was very distracting.
It's interesting because it was directed by John Fortenberry, who ended up being a major director on Arrested Development too. So it's weird seeing them kind of not have the style down yet.
Yeah.
It is really weird. I could, especially on the subject of single camera comedies, this has to be one of those things where an executive saw it and was like, "See, this doesn't work."
Yeah.
You gotta have, you know, you got to do a stage production, three camera comedy. This clearly isn't working, and I'm blaming I'm blaming the camera work, not how unfunny it is.
Yeah.
Like, well, and it doesn't. Also, getting back to the pilot to pilot thing, they literally have the same plot.
Yeah, they do.
The son is breaking up with his family.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like there's that beat where it's like in the first act where it's like revealed that the main character, like the anchor, doesn't want to be the anchor anymore. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like this is like, you know, the whole like arc of the pilot is like the Leo Gorlick, just like Michael Bluth, is like, I'm done with these people. They are causing me a lot of turmoil. So I'm done with it. And they have this like, they both have this like feeling of satisfaction with that decision at the beginning of it, but then they just get sucked back into their family.
Yeah, they get sucked back into a situation which creates the central conflict.
Yeah.
And also, of course, like his brother, now in Everything's Relative, he has one sibling instead of several siblings. But the one sibling feels closest to maybe Job from Arrested Development. The one who just like comes into the room like a bull in a china shop and just blows up whatever's happening. And I think one of the critical differences is that Job's behavior is ridiculous, but he's also like this wannabe try-hard magician. He doesn't really have a job and he's just part of this overall dysfunctional sibling dynamic. Whereas in this show, the sibling is supposed to be like a doctor.
He's a surgeon.
Like a qualified surgeon who knows what he's doing. So his personal life behavior doesn't quite feel like it fits with his supposed level of education and job.
No. It's really weird. It's Arrested Development, except none of them are characters, right?
Yeah.
Like it is literally like as cartoonish as Arrested Development is, the you know, and this is evident in the pilot of Arrested Development. These are characters with motivations and things and lives, and you know you know, they're not just waiting for the scene to start.
Yeah.
But in this show, they're just waiting, like, they have nothing. There's nothing going on.
Yeah.
I would just argue that it's just, it blows my mind that, despite the similarities, it blows my mind that this is Mitchell Hurwitz, because this is one of the worst written things I've ever seen. And I include it on a big list of crap. Like, this has no style, no humor. This has nothing in it. This is a bad show, poorly written. This is all of the problem is in the writing, all of it.
How do you really feel, Barry?
Yeah, and also I also want to belabor the character development thing even further, because Arrested Development in the pilot introduces significantly more characters. And I mean, the main cast of Arrested Development, I just counted off the poster, is nine people. And
it's
in just that first 22 minutes, like you said, they all have clear motivations. They're all real characters, and it introduces all of them. What are they trying to do with their lives? Where do they live? What is the central conflict? What are their arcs going to be? Like, it brings clarity to nine characters.
I feel like he must have gotten tons of notes on his original efforts and then ran with it. Like, personally,
don't shoot your first drafts, people.
Personally, there were parts of this that I thought were clever. Like, I could see some of the humor and some of the funny dialogue style that you see later in Arrested Development in this show, but this show is too grounded and the pacing is really bad.
Oh, the pacing.
Like, there's not enough. It's like in Arrested Development, the style of humor really works because it's so punchy and so fast, and there's a lot of stuff crammed into an episode, especially the pilot.
Yeah.
Like, the pilot, so much happens. Like, there's a lot of action. There's a lot of cuts. There's a lot of non sequiturs and things
clever
like that.
Clever edits. Yeah. Really clever edits.
Whereas this is very slow paced, and, you know, there's little things. Like, I really liked at the end of the, in the final scene of the episode of Everything's Relative, where they're having the engagement party for Marty. That his, you know, fiance doesn't even know about. Like, it's just, I thought that was kind of a clever scene. Like, there were little beats in there that I had, I didn't laugh out loud, but I thought, oh, that's cute. Like, when, you know, Marty goes up and gives his own little speech and he's like, you know, I could probably just fall asleep while standing here. Maybe I should give it a try. And then, I found that clever. Like, he's trying to give his speech and he's closing his eyes and trying to, you know, sleep standing up because he's so exhausted from his long hours and whatnot. And there were little things in that, you know, in that scene that I found clever. But the problem is it's so dry and there's no silliness. Like, there's no absurdity to kind of boost it, if that makes sense. So I think all the wackiness that exists in the world of Arrested Development is what gives the jokes that are his signature style that extra punch. Like, it gives
you really nailed it in terms of talking about the pace, because whereas Arrested Development right from the beginning is a very high paced show in terms of plot, this pilot was extremely fast-paced dialogue, but an extremely slow plotting story.
Yeah.
So you have scenes that are just rammed with wall-to-wall conversation, but where those moments, those nuggets that could have worked, are getting lost in this tidal wave of nonstop, kind of chit-chat and banter. Yeah. Whereas Arrested Development, because it's so well edited and because it's very lean, a lot happens, but it's very lean. So it really draws your attention to the moments that work, because it's lots happens, but every time something happens, your attention is very deliberately set on this person is going to say something ridiculous, and you cannot help but pay attention to that one perfect line that's ridiculous. And then the scene ends and it moves on.
this show has these weird, like, the dialogue in it is so weird. And, like, I know what it is because I've done this myself. It's placeholder writing half the time. Like, it's, yeah. I'm, everything has the cadence of a joke, mm-hmm. but there's no right. joke in it.
Yeah.
People are delivering the dialogue like they're telling jokes, but they're not saying anything funny.
Yeah.
Like, it's yeah. really weird to see something like this that made it to air, because I have, like, the opening scene in the department store, I had to watch it again because I was like, was I just tired? Or is it, like, there's no sense to any of the dialogue in the opening
okay,
scene.
Okay, so I'm glad you brought up that scene, because just, I want to loop back to the distracting nature of the camera work. They made such a meal out of that department store, and it becomes such a big part of the...
It's a big set piece.
Big set piece. Big,
that episode.
Big part of the plot in the episode, and we'll get back to some of the other callbacks to the supposed shenanigans of this department store, but, like... the one camera TV comedy style.
Yeah.
One of the benefits is that you can do interesting location work. You can go into what appears to be potentially a real department store and wander around. You're not limited to what you can build on a small stage with a live audience. But that doesn't mean the camera should be constantly moving. It had such a it had like an Aaron Sorkin sort of walk and talk vibe, but without the there's a specific skill to doing that well, which was not present.
Well, Aaron, you had flagged, like, it's giving me, you know, sports night vibes.
Sports
a
night
bit,
vibes,
you know?
But in the exact opposite. Yeah, you're right. So whereas sports
in terms
night
of the production,
yeah, the
of
production,
it.
Sports,
yeah, yeah,
sports night, which was just like a year before this, sports night felt like, okay, maybe Sorkin wants to do a drama, but so many sitcoms were getting funded, so someone threw him money to make a half-hour comedy. And he said, okay, well, I'll do that. I'll do that show, but I'll kind of fit in my ideas that are based on, like, a more dramatic style. Mm-hmm. This is almost like the opposite. It's almost like, clearly they wanted to do a comedy, but they thought, what if we took the grammar, the editing style, the acting style, the camera work, all of those pieces of apparatus from a TV drama and did comedy within that system and just hadn't figured out how to do that yet?
Maybe. I mean, I didn't really have much of a problem with the camera work personally. Like, I think the camera work wasn't as distracting as what they were saying not being funny. Like, the energy lacking in the camera work in some of these things is because there's no meat in the scene. Like, the camera work is the only thing that keeps that scene moving, because if you were watching them just stand there and talk, oh my God, it would have just gone on forever and ever and ever, because nothing they said was good.
You know, they said the word merchandise.
They thought the word merchandise was a joke.
Yeah, they just kept saying it over and over. I
just
want
like
merchandise.
Just like the word fob.
Yeah.
They thought the word fob was hilarious. So they were like, haha, we're just going to keep saying fob. That's not even what that thing's called, by the way.
Yeah, you're right. There was a lot of dialogue that had the cadence of setup, punchline. But there just wasn't one.
Yeah.
There was no setup or punchline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, okay.
Yeah.
So, like, just to explain to people, they spend a lot of time in a department store in the pilot. And by they, we mean Leo and his father, Jake. They're shopping for an engagement gifts for Marty because they're throwing Marty an engagement party. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So they're wandering around this department store for a very, very long time. And they're having kind of a pointless conversation that is not, you know, it's not entertaining, as Barry has already said. And, you know, there's annoying exposition dumps as well that happen. It's like where he
not
just
nearly not well, nearly enough.
Well,
though.
Not enough, but it's like weird things where, you know, there's a salesperson that comes up to help them. And, you know, Jake goes, my other son is a surgeon and. He's getting married. What is the line? It's like, my other son's a surgeon and he's getting married for the third time. And it's like, oh, okay, you're really just gonna like lay that out there. You can like reveal it in a more clever way throughout the episode.
By the way, speaking of revealing those types of details, the main character you've said is a comedy writer.
Yeah.
We know that because we kind of understood what the premise of this show was going into it.
You infer it, sort of. Like, you guys said that, like, you said that Leo and Jake, you said that Leo and Jake worked together. I wasn't sure they did.
Oh, it's like pulling teeth to find that detail. It doesn't like, really become...
He gets his name in the credits in one of the episodes, but I was like, well, maybe he knows the producer, because he doesn't seem to actually work on the show.
Honestly, like, I
think he's a business manager. I think he's, like, a showbiz business manager or lawyer.
Who is?
The dad, Jake.
No. Really?
No, he's like a producer or a writer or something.
I don't think he's
Isn't
anything.
He the boss of that show?
No, there's
it's
a boss
unclear.
In the they show the boss of the show in the fourth episode.
But
they
he do. Has some influence or connection to that show.
But he works he works full-time in the physical building where they make the show.
Right.
We don't know what his role is. We don't know that for sure because he's just stopping by to get lunch with his son. He could literally just be stopping by to get lunch with his son.
Oh, yeah, and to sexually harass his writing partner.
Speaking of which,
you know, is like art imitating life,
yeah,
I guess.
The way that his behavior... Okay, so also, it took a while to extrapolate that she was a writing partner. The whole...
I didn't know who she was either until we got to her office.
Let's be clear. We watched two...
And she goes to the engagement party too, doesn't she?
She does.
She does. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just be clear for the audience. We watched two episodes.
Okay. Yeah.
The pilot and episode 4. And even after watching episode 4, the exact job descriptions of these people, what the dad does, what the son does, whether she is someone's writing partner... These details are still pretty muddy.
Yeah.
Like, they have an office, but they're not credited writers. What?
And the whole thing of like, oh, you got a credit.
Yeah, that's true. That's weird, eh?
Couldn't even follow what that plot was.
I think that there are people, I don't even know. It's weird. They should be credited writers.
It's just sort of like, it's this weird effing thing where, like, towards the end of the fourth episode, like, I was just sort of like, okay, is Mitchell Hurwitz fucking with me? is there some weird meta humor going on that, like, we're just too dumb to understand? Like, because I'm like, there are writers who admit that they're not funny and they don't know how to tell jokes, just like this show is not telling any jokes. There's this non sequitur gag about how, like, the guy's idea of a joke is, and then at the end, you know, we'll shoot a whole episode in Phoenix, but we won't tell anybody that we're shooting in Phoenix, and that's the joke. And then at the end, it'll say we shot Phoenix. And I was like,
and then they did that,
and then they put that title card in at the end of the actual show episode.
I knew they were going to,
but
like, I was just like, that's not funny, but that's the kind of bullshit that you're slinging at me constantly.
Okay,
in this.
Here's my wild swing interpretation of what their roles are. Leo has a job as a writer in an entry level sort of way at this show. This show is a comedy, but it's not a sitcom. It's kind of like...
I think it's a sketch show.
It's a Monday night sketch comedy
show. Yeah, it's a sketch variety show type of thing. And I feel like it's sort of like a play on like an SNL scenario where he got his like job kind of intern level writer. And every week he has to pitch ideas and maybe he'll get to work on an episode or not based on whether... his ideas get chosen against the 5, 10, 20 other writers who are there. And so the whole thing of him getting a credit was the idea that maybe like this was the first time that he successfully pitched an idea and was the lead writer on an episode or a scene and got credited. But the descriptions of the series seem to suggest that he's a writer and that woman who works with him is his writing partner. And they share an office. And his dad seems to work there too, but we do not know what his role is. Except to apparently expect lunches with his son and to very aggressively manhandle this young woman in the sleaziest way possible.
Yeah, it was gross. I'm willing to admit right now that I actually kind of liked the Phoenix job.
Sorry.
Okay, here's how I interpreted that joke. As someone who tries to write funny things to, like, you know, various, like, you know, I wouldn't say successfully, you know, I write like weird stuff. And it's like, I think there's an element of you think it's funny, but you're overthinking it. And that, I feel like that's what that character is doing. Like, he's like overthinking things. And this is what he thinks is funny. And then he tries to make it meta. And they all try to make it meta by putting the title card at the end. I actually chuckled at that, whereas you groaned at it and thought it was dumb.
I respect you know? The enjoyment of the meta joke.
Yeah.
That one didn't get me. But, you know, again, looking at Arrested Development, which does tons of meta humor.
Yeah.
One of the cleverest things in Arrested Development is in some ways a similar type of meta, but just done to a very funny degree with the narrator. Because you have Ron Howard narrating things and often contradicting things that happen on screen, where a character, you know, let's say I'm just pulling a random memory. Job says something like, "I'm the best magician in this state." And then the narrator says he isn't. And just like immediately, like, hard turn contradicts whatever just happened in the plot or in the dialogue. And you know why? I think that works because it's a motif.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it happening and it happens from minute one. Whereas in this show, and we've dealt with this in some other like sitcoms that we've analyzed before, they'll try some like wild swing into like an interesting stylistic choice, but not with the commitment to do it consistently, like 5, 7, 10 times per episode, lots of meta jokes so that, you know, this is the territory the show is going into.
This show is obsessed with running jokes.
It is. Yeah.
There's so many running jokes in it. But
they're not good. You're right.
One of the running joke in it is literally that the guy's Native American name would be running joke. That's their idea of.
I missed that.
Oh, you missed that?
I missed that.
Oh,
I'm like kind of glad I missed that.
It's like a 5-minute conversation.
I remember the conversation. I don't really remember. I think I was kind of blanking out most of that dialogue.
And then they repeat it a couple of times more.
Right.
And the changing room thing is repeated ad nauseum.
See, but I guess that's different from when I'm talking about like a style motif. Like,
oh, no. I'm not saying these are meta jokes. I'm saying they're running.
Yeah,
they're
running jokes. Yeah. But I guess I mean kind of like if you're going to have funny titles or if you're going to have meta text, build that in consistently. But yes, you're right. Yes, like running jokes in terms of the dialogue. Yeah. And that thing with seeing a woman's butt in the change room of the department store or something. What the fuck was with that joke?
It was just gross.
In what world did anyone think that would any way endear us to these characters?
But I don't even care that it was gross. I mean, I'm not a fan of it being gross, but I'm also like, it still wasn't funny.
Not even close to funny.
It wasn't even worded funny. It was just sort of like everything in this. It's just bleh. It's just dialogue, just spit out.
Yeah, I feel like just the fact that it's called Everything's Relative is a red flag.
is that a meta joke? Is that it's such a generic show or such a generic name that he thinks it's funny that he's just making a nonsensical show?
Yeah.
I still hold this weird thing where I think that it being unfunny is somehow funny to Mitch Hurwitz.
Do we think also maybe, okay, it did have better content and was zanier and wackier like Arrested Development, but it was toned down by network notes. And that's why it's bland and boring and was ultimately called Everything's Relative.
I mean, I feel like network notes generally want things to go bigger.
Right. Yeah.
So I feel like this is no.
But
this
it
is
also... too-
This has such a specific voice to it that, like, it's not tampered.
I feel like maybe he tried to write something that was so close to his own experience, and he didn't account for the fact that his own experience is bland.
Well, I think network notes could account for some of the character issues, some of the character design issues. Like, as an example, I've ranted about this. I think when we did the Rachel Gunn RN, I went onto a whole tangent on this. But like, the brother's a doctor, and yet they build all of these jokes, particularly in episode 4, around the idea that he like doesn't have a lot of money. And mm-hmm. that seems to be like a persistent trope of like the person with the job that should pay a lot of money. But let's make sure that this character is somehow like relatable to a predominantly working class audience. So let's make sure we give them like petty money issues. And
well, no, they say he's cheap.
Right.
Sure. But like pulling an insurance scam to save $10 a month transcends ordinary levels of cheap. It's just.
And also an obsession with getting that above ground pool to quote unquote sell to kids. Like, it makes zero sense. Yeah.
But anyway, I guess looping back to my original point, the fact that the brother is a doctor, which is like a very conventional, successful job, doesn't vibe well with the absurdity of the character. And in Arrested Development, they nailed all of that in terms of like the ridiculous lifestyles of all of the characters.
Yeah.
So to me, that could be a network note. It's like, no. The brother's got to be like a doctor, a lawyer, or something successful, because isn't it funny if like the main character is a struggling comedy writer, but his sibling has this like professional job, and that's their competitiveness between the two of them? Like, I could see that being a note. But to your point, Barry, the dialogue, the lack of jokes, just, I can't explain it.
It's so deliberate.
Because everything's so hazy, too. Again, we watched 2 episodes. I feel like of all the shows we've ever reviewed, and this is number 35 so far, this is the least I've ever understood about what the hell is going on after watching 2 episodes of a show.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. I mean, you know me, like every now and then I get something up my butt about one of these shows. But for the most part, I'm a little easier, like, because I just like watching sitcoms. Yeah. So usually I can just sort of fall back into the rhythms of things. And this was so off-putting that I was just like, I don't want to watch this anymore.
It's so funny because Aaron's feedback was that it was also off-putting. He used that exact way to describe it. But I didn't even find it that bad. Which is weird because
what it is, though? You like the kind of bantery dialogue that they're playing for here, which is like very low key and not so trying to put a lot of jokes into it.
Yeah.
So do I. I love banter. Banter is my favorite kind of comedy.
But yeah, I think.
I don't know. Maybe there's something that I'm seeing there. There's like a glimmer of something that I'm seeing there that is missing. But I'm appreciating the nugget of effort that is there. I don't know.
Yeah, you're less cynical. You're less cynical than we are in your interpretation of it.
I have no idea.
But also,
I don't need to defend it. Like, at the end of the day,
please.
It's not a good show. It's not a good show, but there's something about it where I'm kind of like very mildly saying, oh, I see what you did there. It didn't work. But I see what you did there.
I appreciate that. If there's things that you think work, go to bat for those things.
I'm not saying that it did work. I said exactly that. I did not think it worked, but I'm seeing something there.
And I appreciate that because it means that one of us had a slightly less bad time with it. So I'm all for the slight,
oh boy,
the slightly better vibe.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll circle back to the Phoenix joke.
Okay, let's get back into it.
I said it was not funny. I disagree in that it is funny. I like it is a joke that I like. If there was a joke in any of these episodes that I laughed at, I almost laughed at that. Almost. Only because I knew they were going to pay it off at the end of the episode. I was like, they're going to do a title card at the end of the episode. And then they did. And I was like, okay, so you got that. You put the money on the counter and then I took it. So
yeah.
Okay.
You know, but I will match that with one scene that I found mildly amusing where I kind of liked what they were trying to do with it, which was the mom's stand-up comedy tape in episode 4, which I have to admit, like, just the idea that she's kind of like, they've already established her as like, she's recently divorced from the dad who's clearly like a total prick. And
he's a Jeffrey Tambor type.
Yeah, exactly. So, and to be clear, earlier when I said art imitating life, I meant Jeffrey Tambor.
Yeah. She's moving into this new house. She's kind of going through a bit of a midlife crisis type of thing and trying to like get a fresh start in life. And so the idea that she has this ambition to be a stand-up and recorded this tape, and it is kind of endearing, like the way that she does it. And they're laughing at her in a way that's mean-spirited, but we know it's mean-spirited. And ultimately, like, the plot point in the end is that when the team at the show where he works sees the audition tape, they decide that they like it because they think she's funny. Like, it's kind of a nice little payoff for her. I found, like, the mom overall to be maybe the most likable character.
I liked how she called him Biggie Big Shot because it's so stupid, and it's such a, like, that is something like a middle-aged mom would say. I know that sounds like kind of sexist, but I mean, that is, I could see like a mom being like Biggie Big Shot or whatever. Yeah. And then all the characters adopt that name and they call him that in earnest when they're mad at him. They call him Biggie Big Shot, the throwaway line that the mom says, you know?
Yeah. I like, you know what? And this is, yeah, I will also mildly say that I enjoy it. And like, it's the son's not getting, like, obviously, like, some of the momness about it is what makes it funny.
Yeah.
But also, something I really liked, and I'm not 100% sure if I read this right, but I wanted to give it more credit than it was. I felt like at the end of the episode, when she does her little thank you, she knows that she was doing a character.
Right.
Like, when she was doing her act, she knew that it was silly. And like, that's not her naturally saying thank you. Like, she was weird. Like, when you see her do it at the end, I was like, so see, she knew she was doing a bit.
Yeah.
Right.
And they weren't appreciating that about her.
Yeah. Yeah. They underestimated her.
She was once again bombing intentionally.
Right.
Like, she was being unfunny to be funny.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be right. I can see that. The whole time she was kind of doing a bit, and even the thing of how she's like at the end of the audition tape, she says, and this isn't even a real microphone, and then she brushes her hair with the hairbrush that she was using as the mic. And yeah, maybe the whole time, like, the thing
is, that's what she says that she did, isn't it?
What?
That, like, the point you just made, Barry, doesn't she say that to her son? Like, doesn't she imply that to Leo? That
I don't think she says clearly.
Right.
I think she implies it, but because the show is so unclear about everything.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't know if that was her implying, hey, I was doing a bit, or her just them saying that's how she says thank you. Like, the show hadn't gained any goodwill for me. I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt of it was like her doing like absurdist comedy versus her just being like, well, that's how she says thank you and we're going to work it in all the time. I mean, it wasn't that one.
When I saw the scene, I thought she was doing it in earnest and I thought, oh, this is cute and charming that like she thinks this is funny. And then it's a funny twist that the executives at the show did think it was funny. But like, you might be right, the whole time maybe she was doing a bit of like, isn't it funny if I play a character that's this sort of to be a stand-up comic to get on her son's show or something like that, and that's the charm of the character that she's putting on. It works either way, I think.
You know, one thing that I did like about the show, as I usually do, I find Kevin Rahm's energy to be genuinely pleasant anytime I see him.
Same.
The mildest compliment.
I mean, I've always kind of enjoyed seeing him in shows, and it was one of those things where I never really knew who he was, but he would like pop up in things, and I'm like, oh, I like that guy. He's kind of cute, and he has like a good energy.
And
then he like had like a major role in Mad Men later, so it was like, it's like, you know, you see all of those.
Didn't age in between those two roles.
I know. Like, just, I know.
Yeah.
Because that was 20 years later.
Yeah.
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 Man, this show, just thinking about this show is just...
Aw.
No, because there's so many elements to it where I just keep coming back to this, like, it's all a joke on us. Like, because now that I'm thinking about, like, their sketch show, the sketch show is clearly not funny.
Yeah.
And they clearly don't care about making it funny. They're just trying to put whatever on the air because it's a Monday night sketch show.
Maybe that's what's happening here. It's a mid-season, you know, show that's not going to go anywhere.
What a mind fuck,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Was he trolling us the whole time? Like, was Mitchell Horowitz just trolling everybody and just like writing a big meta masterpiece? I don't know. Probably not. But
look,
you know,
Mitchell Horowitz, I know you're a listener. So
yeah, exactly. You're clearly listening. Yeah.
I hope my comments about you were not too unkind because I come at it from a place of being such a huge fan that it really throws me for a loop when this, you know.
Well, exactly. Not unlike our previous episode about a different Everything's Relative, where we had to like explain a similar disclaimer about because we're such huge fans of Jason Alexander, it was particularly intriguing to see a role so recently before where all of the things that work a couple years later are
in Seinfeld.
Seinfeld are not working in that Everything's Relative. And here it's like, we know it's the same Mitch Horowitz. There are, like we pointed out, certain similarities in the concept, but all the things that land in Arrested Development a few years later don't work here. Like Arrested Development, so the polar opposite, you know, meticulously constructed to the point where I remember thinking back in the day when I watched that show for the first time, I thought, how did people write this show? It's so complicated and there's so many like callbacks and call forwards. Like it really felt like they wrote a 30-hour script all in one sitting and then chopped it up into episodes because everything just like puzzle pieces locks in so perfectly in that show that it felt almost impossible to write.
Would you say it was relative? Everything was relative.
Yeah. And of course, Arrested Development, very funny. But the visual grammar works.
This is also our third show that we've watched that had Mitchell Horowitz as a big part of the writer's.
That's true.
Oh.
Golden Palace.
Yes, he wrote for Golden Palace. Yeah.
Most importantly, the John Larroquette show.
Yes.
Which we all love.
It's like, it's like he's one of these interesting figures where he is a really talented guy and he creates memorable things that a lot of people love and he has a devoted following, but it's all so specific and it's also hit or miss. Like it's just, he's a very interesting guy. He's like the king of like failures, some of which were not deserved to be failures. And some that were like, you know, should have been locked up in a vault forever, like this show.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
He is a very interesting figure. Mm-hmm. Can I blurt out some random trivia about him that I didn't know?
Yes.
Apparently, when he was like a very young kid, like a teen, he started a cookie company. He created a cookie stand called the Chipyard of Boston. You know, like the shipyard.
The shipyard. Yeah.
And that was what, like, inspired the banana stand in Arrested Development.
I love that piece of trivia.
Isn't that fun?
There's always money in the banana stand.
Maybe there was always money in the shipyard. So he felt confident to take these creatives.
Yeah, you could go back at any time.
Yeah. He felt confident enough to make these creative swings over and over again. And it didn't matter if they failed because there was always money in the chipyard.
They're pushing back at him, you know, in network meetings. And they're like, you got to cut this joke, man. He's like, hey, I don't need this.
I got the chipyard.
Yeah, I got the chipyard of Boston. Yeah. And they're like, look, Mitch, calm down. You can keep the joke. We understand. Well, it's fine.
And you know what? Like, I'm remembering this thing, like talking about taking bold swings. When Arrested Development, of course, it got reborn by Netflix years later because it developed a huge cult following on DVD. But for anyone listening who doesn't know the backstory, it ran for 2.5 seasons and it did get canceled.
Yeah.
Like
full
yes,
three. Got three. A full three. Third season was in the writer's strike. That's why it's short.
Yes, it's shorter, but they knew midway through the third season that yeah. the show was basically on thin ice. And there are meta jokes built into the show about the notes they were getting from the network that mm-hmm. were going to ultimately result in the show getting canceled, which is
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And there's a whole thing from the narrator talking about.
Now I want to watch
how,
the third season.
You know, he
of
says,
that.
like, there's some plot point that happens, and the narrator jumps in and says, like, it was some real stakes with the necessity yeah. to, like, solve these obstacles or whatever. And, like,
yeah, you're right. Because in some of the last episodes, they're talking about. Because this was after they had done a huge campaign to get both Showtime and HBO to pick up the show.
Yeah, to buy
right.
them out.
And both of them turned it off. And like they were like, well, I guess it's time for Showtime. Or then there
yeah,
was like...
Exactly.
They were like, oh, the...
Oh, I forgot about that.
How are we going to...
I gotta rewatch this.
How are we going to save the company? And it was like, oh, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to talk to the Home Builders Owners Association.
Yeah.
And they're like, yes, maybe it will be the HBO for us.
The HBO who saves us or whatever.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
my
yeah, yeah.
God.
Because, that... yeah, because they knew that this yeah, that this yeah. conflict was happening with the network.
Yeah.
And the narrator built all these jokes about it into the yeah. descriptions of the characters and the plot points because
yeah.
apparently they were getting all these notes saying like, you need to have real stakes and you need yeah. characters with real payoffs and real arcs and you need to, but it feels like he was yeah. willing to go down with the ship on that show and just go down swinging with these meta jokes. Whereas yeah. everything's relative. There are some areas where it's doing something playful or different from the cookie cutter sitcoms of the time, but yeah. not bold enough.
Yeah, not enough to hook people in.
Not that full blown kind of like a Larry David, like my way or I'm quitting sort of energy
yeah.
to really carry it through into making those bold swings work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I just want to like point something out right now. This is kind of like an aside, but I'd like to point out that we spent the first Everything's Relative episode of That Was a Show mostly talking about Seinfeld, and now we're doing the same thing for this Everything's Relative episode, mostly talking about Arrested Development. So
and you can hear it in our voices. We're in both of these episodes, we're talking ourselves into being like, I know, well, I'm probably just gonna watch a couple episodes after I'm done.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we literally watched, we had to watch the pilot of Arrested Development, Aaron and I, after we watched yeah. the two episodes of these. We're like, we need something better. We need better Hurwitz. Like
I started to, but like I have seen the pilot for Arrested Development
1,000 times. Yeah.
Yeah, 1,000 times. And yeah. like I can do it beat by beat. So like even mm-hmm. watching yeah. it, it's like this. There's even a moment in both pilots where like somebody comes up behind the other person and starts awkwardly massaging their neck.
Yeah, Buster.
Yeah,
Buster in Arrested Development, and then Jake in this.
Yeah,
but not right. to the girl, to his son. He does yeah. it to his son, and he like freaks his son out.
Oh, man.
Which is a moment I kind of love in Arrested Development. Oh my god, I'm sorry.
It's
a moment I love in Arrested right? Development because like it's like such a like family moment where you're just like,
yeah.
What does like, the expression "everything's relative" even mean? Like, I know both shows are using it because they're like talking about family relationships. So it's meant to be a cute little like
yeah, your relatives, your family.
Yeah, but "everything's relative" is an expression that means something different, and I think that
Google,
there's a
please Google this.
There's a comment there because we're like I feel like I'm trying to make a connection between that and how we're treating these shows
yeah.
in these podcast episodes. Like,
well, the fact that we're even wondering what does the title mean in both of these cases speaks to this lack of narrative clarity. If I were to summarize.
No. I know what it means in the terms of the show. I mean, in general, because that they're using it in a different way than it's intended.
Yeah,
the definition, the saying everything is relative means the way in which you perceive the world is by way of an individual experience.
Okay.
Is what the
yeah, subjectivity.
Means. Which, yeah. weirdly enough, is a conversation that comes up in the pilot at one point.
Okay.
They're talking about being an individual and perceiving the world. It's weird. Also, Arrested Development, which is a great title, is also just a weird, like, they're like, haha, you know, like, development, like, you know.
Yeah, it actually is a similar type of title.
Housing development.
Double
but
meanings,
also,
yeah.
But also growing up.
Yeah,
it's a similar type of double entendre title.
I never got that until you said that. I only thought it was, like, Arrested Development in that they are all, their development was all arrested because they're idiots.
But they're a housing development company.
Yes, now I finally get that joke.
Well, okay, so I guess what I want to say, because this came up in, like, the previous Everything's Relative, I can't remember which of you made a reference to the Drew Carey show.
Oh, I did.
You did.
Yeah.
As an example of
grounded blue collar comedy.
Grounded.
Well, no, it's okay. So I was referencing the Drew Carey show because I was trying to, actually, did I do that in this episode?
Yeah, yeah. We were talking about the fact that the main character played by Jason Alexander in that show had an absurdly complicated and hard to understand job, and that a character like Drew Carey in the Drew Carey show being a more generic businessman, middle management type gives a better platform for the comedy.
That's a very apt point about the show we talked about last time, but I don't think that's
the
what it was either.
The point I made with Drew Carey was that he was someone, like, in that character in the Drew Carey show was self-deprecating.
Right.
But he was the anchor, and he was not self-assured, but he was warm to others, and he was likable, but he was, like, you know, self-deprecating. And that's what we thought Jason Alexander's character in Everything's Relative should have been. Instead of so cocky and self-assured.
Right. Yeah. It's the cocky, self-assured thing.
Aaron, that was amazing, though.
That was great.
That is just like your misremembering of the John Larroquette show. You have this convenient, like, misremembering. And, like, it's so good.
I like that you're just like, now we're just full on talking about another sitcom that we were like, it's like me being like just segueing into being like, you know, I was thinking about something about Whoops yesterday.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Rabbit holes were going down for this dumb show.
I conflated a couple of different aspects of that show that we were talking about. Misremembering how which of those things that we were critiquing connected with Drew Carey.
Yeah.
But the point I was going to make is that it feels like one of the lessons we've learned, especially from both Everything's Relatives and in general from the sitcoms we've analyzed that don't quite work, is that there's like an aspect of narrative clarity that needs to be in a sitcom where you understand, like, are these characters relatable sort of everyman, everywoman types, or are they kind of goofy, oddball, absurd characters? Is the situation they're in very kind of comically mundane and low-key and low-concept, like the Drew Carey show, or like The Office, or even like Friends, or is it something really high-concept? And Arrested Development decisively knows it's a high concept show with oddball characters. And this show, I don't think it knows, or at least it's not presenting to us, the audience, in two episodes. Are these characters supposed to be in any way relatable? What are their jobs? What are their dynamics with each other? Like, where is all of this going? It's just like kind of lacking that clarity. And if it had taken one of those two paths more clearly, maybe there would have been somewhere to go with it.
Yeah.
So, Bryn, I think it's about that time where you can connect Everything's Relative 1999 to Friends in 6 degrees or less. I just want to ask, should we play distractingly loud jazz music underneath you doing this the way that Everything's Relative did through several scenes?
No, I'll pass on that.
Okay. Okay. See, that's an astute choice. You'll pass on that.
Yeah. All right. So
I wish somebody else had said that.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, there are very close connections to friends. The first one is a 2-degree connection. So Jill Clayburg, who played Mickey Gorlick on Everything's Relative, was also in the film Fools Rush In. And the lead of that movie was Matthew Perry. And then Matthew Perry, of course, was Chandler Bing on Friends.
I was trying to remember if it was a Perry or a Schwimmer.
Yeah. One of the few, well, I guess he's done a few movies, but it's one of his
Schwimmer. Who, Perry or Schwimmer?
Well, both. Like a handful.
Weird that, you know, they're both so good and they don't get a lot of movie work.
It's weird. Okay, and then the other one is a 1-degree connection through the delightful Kevin Rahm. So he played Leo Gorlick on Everything's Relative. And he also guest starred on Friends. So in the episode called The One with Rachel's Date, he plays Tim, who is Monica's sous chef, who she wants to fire. But because Phoebe starts dating him, she holds off until after Phoebe dumps him, basically.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's
so
good.
That's
connection.
Our friend Kevin Rahm.
Yeah, there you go. There's a nice there's a 1 degree there for you.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Time for the spinoff?
Yeah, why not? Let's do it. Everybody in the main cast continued to act. That's the shortest answer possible. So Kevin Rahm continued to be a successful TV actor. He's been a memorable guest star and reoccurring character in many sitcoms and dramas over the years, including a role on Desperate Housewives. He played Ted Chaw on Mad Men, as we already mentioned. He was also in Bates Motel and Madam Secretary, to name a few. Jill Clayburg, who played the mother, the matriarch on Everything's Relative, Mickey Gorlick, was already an established actor, and she continued to work a lot in both film and television, appearing in Ally McBeal soon after this, A Leap of Faith, Dirty Sexy Money, and films like Love and Other Drugs. And her final role was the movie Bridesmaids, where she played Annie's mom, and she was very funny in that. And it was actually released after her death. So she passed, sadly, in 2010, and Bridesmaids was released in 2011. So we got one last role where she was like very delightful and very, very funny. Like she played the perfect kind of, actually, she played the character that she should have been in Everything's Relative, I think, where she was like this like mom who would say kind of zany things randomly and had like, you know, eccentricities, but was like a very supportive mom.
Was she Kristen Wiig's mom?
Yes. Hmm. So Kristen Wiig's character, Annie, she played her mom. And Eric Schaefer, who played Marty. I don't know. He's had kind of a wild career. Like, he doesn't really have much going on these days, at least as far as I can see on IMDb. He has been one of these people who's tried his hand at acting, writing, directing, all of it. And he's been very passionate about his own projects, which I admire. But they haven't really been very successful. So, you know, I can see that he's a talented guy in this show and other things I've seen him in. And, you know, maybe he should have like just like acted in other people's projects more. I don't know. And then I don't want to talk about Jeffrey Tambor. I'm just going to skip over him. And Mitchell Hurwitz, as we have already talked to at length, went on to create Arrested Development. It's a cult classic, or is it now a mainstream classic? I don't really know at this point, but he's won many awards and accolades for his work on that show. And it's basically a legendary show, whether or not you personally think it is successful or not. He also created a couple of other shows that have a fan following, including Running Wild and Lady Dynamite was his most recent project.
Cool.
He played Coogler on Community.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
One thought I had as you were saying that is, you know, is Arrested Development a cult success or a mainstream success?
Yeah.
I actually think Arrested Development answers that question for itself, because when the show was originally created in 2003 and went for depending on your interpretation, 2.5 or 3 seasons. It wasn't really a success at the time. It went off the air and it got released on DVD and became a huge cult success. Then it got picked up to be reborn on Netflix in an era where that is all you need to expect out of a show, because the idea that a TV comedy needs to be quote unquote mainstream went out the window when Netflix decided that all they care about is that this show has a audience, not the audience, and that that mm-hmm. audience is willing to pay the subscription fee to be able to get it. So you can make 100 shows that appeal to 100 different cohorts instead of trying to make the one show that appeals to everyone. So it's almost like Arrested Development 1.0 and Arrested Development 2.0 straddle that transition in TV comedy.
Yeah.
Which is sort of odd in that I would say that the original run of Arrested Development was probably watched a lot more. Like,
oh yeah.
No, yeah. I'm the only person I know that has finished the show.
That's a good point, because I haven't finished. I think I've finished the most recent season, the 2020 season or whatever.
Yeah, I'm definitely guilty of having not finished it, in spite of clearly I'm like ranting at length about how much I love that show. When I say I love Arrested Development, I love the original 3 seasons of Arrested Development. Just like how when I say I love The Simpsons, I love seasons 3 through 11 of The Simpsons. I have not seen seasons 15 onward mm-hmm. of The Simpsons, which is apparently still going for some reason.
Fox money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, isn't everything relative?
Stop.
You know what? That's a good joke. You win a free bagel. Let's turn that into a 5-minute plot point.
Or a swimming pool.
Oh, I want that swimming pool. Just like, you know, I'm someone who does not need a swimming pool and has no business having a swimming pool, but I want to win it to sell it to neighborhood kids.
Sure, sure. Yeah. It's a relatable joke.
And on that confusing note, you know who might be able to explain this this baffling artifact from the 90s? Our good buddy, Mr. Producer.
Yeah, I guess we could give him a call, see what he's up to.
Hello, Anthony Producer's office. How may I direct your call?
Mr. Producer, is that you?
Oh, Aaron, how are you? How's it going today, my boy?
What was that all about?
Ah, you know, my secretary's out of town, so I've been doing the phones.
But you're just directing calls to yourself, aren't you?
Oh, sure. Or, you know, to Gary.
Who's Gary?
Hey, he's my assistant. Well, and my nephew.
So why not have Gary mind the phones?
So he's out of town, too.
So then why?
Well, it doesn't matter. So what are you calling about today?
We're talking about everything's relative.
Oh, yeah, sure. The Jason Alexander vehicle from the 80s. You know, I wasn't
Not that one, actually. The other one.
Oh, sure. You mean the 1996 Sharon Pollock film. Well, I gotta say, you know, it wasn't necessarily...
No. The other one.
Oh, yeah, sure. The situational comedy about Albert Einstein's time in the patent office. You know, Aaron, I think that one was actually called Everything's Relativity.
No, that one wasn't.
Oh, sure. The other one. The one about Jay Hines's time trying to bring his favorite sweet and tangy condiment to everyone's kitchen table.
Is that a...
That one was called Everything's Relish.
Mr. Producer, can we just... Wait, is that one real?
It's my dream project, kid. I once spent 2 weeks in the Poconos with Francis Dolarhyde, Matt Bopp, and Anthony Michael Hall just trying to break the script.
What happened to it?
Ah, you know, we lost it. Miramax went forward with that Michael Caine French's Mustard biopic.
So, wait, okay. What were we talking about?
We were talking about Everything's Relative.
Right. The Mitchell Hurwitz Show. Did you know anything about that?
No, I can't say that I did.
Okay, well, talk to you next time, I guess.
Catch you later, kid. Hello, Anthony Producer's office. How may I direct your call?
Well, thanks everyone for listening to another episode about another Everything's Relative. And I guess cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show.
Radio Gizmo.